about in the overall big picture, and this is not a totally inclusive list. One of the first things that comes to my mind, and this is partially because of my background building a network security auditing tool, is you have to be able to audit things. You have to understand where your problems are on your network. You have to understand where you're vulnerable. If you're not running some type of security auditing tool, preferably more than one security auditing tool, on your network on a regular basis, you have no idea where your problems actually are. And you're probably leaving yourself wide open to all sorts of problems. Next, you need to run some type of intrusion detection. Critics of intrusion detection tell me, well, I can get by it with this, that, and the other thing. My question to them is, would you rather know about some of the attacks that are coming after you or none of the attacks that are coming after you? I'll take some of them. Intrusion detection may not be perfect, but it's a useful tool and it should be used. One of the next most important things is to roll out patches properly. You need to be able to do this in an efficient manner. You need to be able to do so quickly. Need to monitor information sources. You need to understand what new issues are coming up on a daily basis. New things come up every day, and you need to be able to assess that threat to your environment and react to that threat. And you also need to be able to design your network in a secure manner. You need to try and set things up secure in the first place rather than, oh, well, let's just get it running and then we'll worry about how to secure it later. That's a sure prescription for disaster. You also need to establish a security policy. In Mudge's keynote speech last year at this conference, this is one of the biggest things that he stressed, and it's one of the areas where I most agree with him. If you don't have a good, solid security policy, then you're laying yourself in for tons and tons of problems. People need to understand what they need to comply with. You can't just let, you know, some security guy go off and say, you know, this is what you got to do. It's got to be written down somewhere, and it's got to have high-level buy-in. I'll get to a little more of that later. Next, you need to be able to understand and identify where your high-value targets are. People don't really necessarily think about that all the time. And there, you've got some high-value targets on your network that you may not be necessarily aware are high-value targets. You need to plan for security, and also when you get hacked, not if you get hacked, but when you get hacked, you need to react properly to compromises in order to stop the problem instead of just allowing it to continue. Okay. Since this is one of the most important things, this is what I wanted to start with, is how to implement a security policy and some things that are very important there. First of all, you need to negotiate a policy that users and administrators can agree on. If the users do not agree to follow the policy, then it's going to become, it's worthless. It's impossible to enforce. People will go around it. A policy that is looser than the security guys would like, which is something that people will actually follow and go along with, is actually a stronger and better policy than something that makes the security guys just totally happy and everybody ignores. You know, the security guys, they're always worried about all these threats that never happen. And end users will do that. As soon as they get in the habit of blowing off and subverting your security policy, all is lost. You may as well not have one. So make one that everybody can agree on. One of the very most important things, and this is something else that Mudge pointed out in his speech, you have to have high-level support. You have to have an 800-pound gorilla near the top of the organization who's willing to enforce your security policy, because at some point it's going to come down to an argument between you and somebody who's just who says, well, I'm just trying to get my job done. If I have to comply with this, it's going to slip product or it's going to cause me massive inconveniences and so on and so on. You need to be able to come down on those people and say, well, you've got to do it right because otherwise here's the consequences. And if you planned on doing it right in the first place, maybe you wouldn't be worrying about slipping the product. Your lack of planning in the past shouldn't be an emergency on my part. So high-level support is very, very important. It's crucial. You also need to use plain language. If people don't understand this policy, then they're certainly not going to follow it. Okay? Next, you need to understand trade-offs. You're not going to be able to achieve perfect security. It's just not going to happen. There are constraints. You can improve security if you're willing to spend more money. You can improve security if you're willing to spend more time. But if you don't have enough of either, then there's only so much security you're going to get. Accept that. Okay? Most of us don't have our homes secured about like Fort Knox. So try and apply a level of security that is appropriate for your environment and figure out where that is appropriate. As security people, sometimes we tend just to focus on security and we say, get it secure, I don't care what it costs. Well, guess what? The bean counters at the top, they care how much it costs and they're only going to give you so many of them. It's also essential to develop a threat model. You need to understand where things are going to be coming at you. Some terminology here to look at is, we all know what an attack is. That's something that's trying to get you. That's something that's trying to cause you some form of harm. A vulnerability is a problem that exists that could allow attack to succeed. Now, target value is something that is often neglected because an attack against a high value target is a much, much bigger problem than an attack against a low value target. And there may be some types of attacks which you don't necessarily consider to be a problem against a low value target that you do against a high value target. For example, if somebody can cause a denial of service attack against www.microsoft.com, that's a big problem. If somebody can cause a denial of service attack against my machine sitting out on some other part of the internet, then it's a problem for me, but it's not a problem for the company as a whole. So there's different types of things that you may want to worry about depending on the overall value of your target. And also, an attack against a vulnerable low-value target might not be a big problem. So you have to triage. I mean, when you're looking at a network of very large number of machines, you could be looking at trying to fix a very, very large number of problems. You have to be able to start somewhere. There's some of it that you probably just aren't going to be able to get to right away. So let's think about identifying our high value targets. Where are they? What are they? Well, some of them are obvious. Some of our high value targets are very obvious. Okay, you've got your DNS servers, you've got your web servers, you've got your domain controllers, a lot of other very critical servers that you depend on to run your business, and if they go down, it's a big problem. But there's a lot of targets that are very high value that aren't really quite so obvious. Maybe not to the network administrators, but they're very obvious to the hackers. They're very obvious to someone like me who's doing penetration testing. Your sysadmin's workstation, he doesn't think necessarily that it's a big deal. It's just my workstation. There's nothing valuable kept on it except his credentials. So think about that. Okay? You've got systems running services as highly privileged users. That's another high value target. If one of those systems can be compromised, you're going to give away an awful lot of your overall network. So that's another high-value target. Lastly, don't neglect systems belonging to legal, HR, your boss, the executives. You really, really don't want to let the top-level people at your company get nailed with just about anything. So take care of them. They'll appreciate it. And as it says in the Ferengi Rules of Acquisition, never hurts to suck up to the boss. Now, you need to understand security dependencies. This is one of the biggest areas that is really neglected in most classic penetration testing techniques, and what you get out of auditors, what you get out of your penetration testers, what you get out of your security auditing tools. I made a small effort to put some of that in the ISS scanner when I was last at ISS, but it's very rudimentary. What the problem is all these machines are connected, and I can take over one, and that allows me to take over another, and it allows me to continue to expand my sphere of influence until eventually I can take over what I want. As an attacker, I am very rarely going to go directly for the target that I want to hit. I'll work my way around it until I know that I've gained enough access to take it over, and then I'll go in and get it. Okay? That's the way that your attacker is going to be thinking, and it's the way you need to be thinking. And it gets to be some very interesting problems. And I'll give some examples of this. So one of the first rules of this is that any local administrator can execute code under the context of any other user logged on locally. Okay, this is also true for Unix systems, and instead of administrator, of course, it's root. If you can control the operating system, you can execute code under the context of anyone else who's logging in on that operating system locally and to some extent remotely. This is true for just about every commercial operating system that's out there. A little bit less true with your B-level stuff, that type of thing. Now, your types of attacks can include direct attacks. You can have something where I can do something and immediately I'm running code as one of my victims. It can be indirect. It could be a Trojan horse attack. It could be some other form of landmine where I've maybe installed a password sniffer. Maybe I've gone to my friend Greg Hoagland's rootkit.com site, downloaded rootkit. Now I've got that installed. It can also include credential theft. There's a number of ways to steal the credentials of somebody who's on a machine that you control. So this is how you're going to be expanding influence, and this is why these types of connections are things that are absolutely critical. Now here's the first example. We've got a master domain, we've got two branch domains under it, and Larry is a domain admin on the master domain. So he's got a lot of privileges. Now he's got a workstation that he's joined to domain A, and he's neglected to do anything with the local administrators group. So it's sitting there at default. And so domain A, domain admins, is administrator, is on Larry's machine. And he's got an SQL service running as himself under his own credentials. And it's sitting there running all the time. What we're looking at here is a big problem. It's what I call a dependency loop. The problem here is that the credentials needed to compromise Larry's machine are domain A, domain admins. So now the security of the master domain is dependent upon the ability of the branch domain to keep its domain admins group secure. Okay, so we've got a loop. What we've also done is we've unwittingly promoted all the domain A admins to domain admins on master domain. That's really probably not what we wanted to do. So the solution, obviously, here is to substitute domain A, domain admins, with master domain admins. And now the credentials needed to get into Larry's workstation are equivalent to those that you will gain by getting into Larry's workstation. So Larry's workstation at that point is no longer something that you can use necessarily to escalate privilege in a meaningful manner. Maybe you can go from being one domain admin to being another domain admin, and there are cases where that could be useful, but it's not going to allow me to escalate myself from a low-level domain admin to a high-level domain admin. You've got things like this all over your networks, so look at them, look for them. Now here's another one to think about, okay? We've got a good number of admins. We've got Larry, Curly, Mo, and Shep. And there's a good reason I picked the Three Stooges. It's because they really most closely resemble some of the administrators I've run across in many, many different places. It seems to be a worldwide problem. So here we go. We've got these four machines. We've got three critical servers, and we've got test hosts. And Shep set it up, and he set it up insecurely. Now I come along, I compromise test host. Test host allows me to steal Mo's credentials. Now that I've stolen Mo's credentials, I can take over critical server 3, can steal Larry's credentials. Now I can go over and I can take over critical server 2. I can compromise the underscore service account. Now I've got more credentials. Then I can go to critical server 1, compromise it. Now I've got Curly's credentials. Eventually, I'll be able to take over the entire network if I haven't achieved that already, all starting out with one test host off in the corner. Okay, so when you're looking at securing a critical server, there's a lot of other critical servers that you may not have thought of that were critical. Who would have thought that test host was a critical server? It takes a little bit of work to understand that. And that's one of the things that you need to do and one of the things that you need to deal with. Because if I'm worrying about securing a given machine, I also need to secure all the systems that could possibly compromise that machine. I need to secure all the systems where all the administrators of that system log on. So think about that. Your zeroth order attack is, can I take over this machine directly? That's what most people look for. Well, you know, I tried everything I knew. I ran 15 different scanners against it. I didn't find anything wrong with it. It's secure. You're probably wrong. It's probably not secure. Because there's some other machine that one of the administrators for that machine logs onto on a regular basis, and nobody looked at that machine, and it's not secure. Your first order approach is to say, all right, well, for all the administrators there are on that machine, let's go make sure that all their machines are secure. Everywhere they go, those are also secure. So that would be a first order approach. A second order approach would be to evaluate who are all the administrators on this first level group. Now let's go make sure that all their machines are secure as well. If you don't have a really well-configured network, this can spread until eventually you come to the conclusion that if I take over the receptionist box down in the lobby, eventually I'll be able to take over everything everywhere. That's a situation that you want to avoid, and so you want to try and break those chains so that eventually you have a bounded set of computers to look at in order to determine that this computer over here is secure. There are some interesting problems in path analysis that go along with this type of thing. It's a mathematically complex problem, which probably accounts for the reason that we don't see a lot of really good tools out there. But we can look at this and we can go a long way towards solving it. Because consider that you know, I go out and I hire, you know, super security corp who's got all the whiz-bang hackers and turn them loose on my network, and I say, okay, take over, you know, this source control server over here, and if you can do that, then, you know, I'll consider your exercise complete. Well, so they do, and they go find some way to do that. And then I go along and I fix all the problems that allows that. Now, let's say I have an unlimited consulting budget. So then I get them back in the next week. I give them the same task. Well, they find another way to get there. And they find another way to get there. And they keep on going until eventually I get sick and tired of having consultants hanging around figuring out new ways to break into things. So it's one of the biggest problems with penetration testing is they will find a path to the target. And it will help. You can find things that you need to close. Well, you need to fix this and this and this and this. But when they leave, are you secure? Not really. They haven't really assured anything. Only by starting at the target and rigorously analyzing everything that you need to get to that target can you have any sort of hope of understanding how to prevent people from getting there. It's a complicated problem. And when you're dealing with a very, very large network like I am, it's a very complicated problem. So this is, if I leave you with anything today, this is something I really want you to think about, is the security dependencies and the fact that a lot of your critical servers are probably not the ones that you know about. They're probably some test box off in a corner, because that's where people are going to come in. And that's where people are going to be able to escalate privilege until they can take you over. A couple of techniques to approach is, for one thing, limit the number of admin level accounts. Obviously, if 400 people aren't allowed to be admins on this given machine, I've got a much smaller population to go check. So try and limit that. Try and limit the scopes that people have. If possible, create a good number of admin level groups so that you can put a few of them in this group, a few of them in that group. Give them scope. Use the principle of least privilege. Give them enough scope to do what they need to do and no more. And this helps you control the problem. Know where your administrators log on. If they're logging on to a system, it's a critical system. And you need to be aware of that, and they need to be aware of that. I don't know how many times I've called up somebody and said, man, your machine's got this, you know, fill in stupid security hole here. You know, didn't you know to solve? Well, it's just my workstation. Well, if I take over your workstation, won't that allow me to do this? You know, and then I get a dead silence on the phone while they, you know, it sinks in. You know, the Cluebird flies over. So educate them, because they're not necessarily thinking about security. They're thinking about how to make it up, you know, how to make everything work. They're thinking about keeping things running. They're not thinking necessarily about security. You also need to manage domain service accounts very carefully. You need to know which machines they're installed on and who are the administrators on those machines, because those can really lead to some very interesting dependency issues. Getting things fixed. That's one of the more interesting problems on a big network. If you can identify problems and you don't have a way to get them fixed, then really probably what you're doing is you're creating a legal liability for yourself. Because if the stockholders ever find out that you have not been using due diligence in protecting your corporate assets, you're in big trouble. You will have hordes of lawyers coming down upon you, and that's really not a good thing. So you have to be able to get things fixed. One of the first things you need to do is you need to identify responsible parties for critical systems. You need to be able to know who those people are. This is a very difficult problem in a large organization because it's always changing. The guy who was responsible for this over here and, you know, always got things fixed and he was a real good guy, you know, well, What do you mean he left the company next week? Well, who's supposed to replace him? Keeping track of all these types of things is a job in and of itself, but it's a very, very important job, because if you can't find them, if you can't get them fixed, then it's no good. You also need to get as close to the person who is responsible for the machine as possible. The more layers of bureaucracy there are between you and the person who actually puts their hands on the machine and fixes it, the more chances there are for the ball to get dropped and the longer it's going to take to propagate. You send mail to somebody who sends mail to somebody who sends mail to somebody, and before you know it, it takes you 3 or 4 days to respond to the critical hole. Meanwhile, the hackers are coming in at you in all directions. So if you can get as close as you can to the people who are actually going to put their hands on the system, the better off you are. And one of the best things you can do is try and obtain a service level agreement from your operations group. If a hard drive blows up, they've got a certain number of hours to remedy that problem, or they face some sort of penalty. They've got some sort of operational threshold for this machine went down, therefore I have to fix it in a given amount of time. So if you can implement that type of thing for a security problem, then you have a really good solid weapon for that. And it's often difficult to get operational people to look at a security problem the same way that they would a failed hard drive. But strive for that goal. It's very important. Okay. Auditing security. Policy that cannot be enforced is useless. It's absolutely useless. So I've got this policy in that says that end users who are razzed into my corporate network can't reroute their, can't change their routing tables so that they can get to the internet at the same time as they can get to corporate. Okay, fine, that's a pretty sensible policy. But do I have a way to find people who aren't complying with that rule? Well, if the answer is no, then why have the policy? You know, why have rules that you can't enforce? If you can figure out a way to enforce the rule, great, put it in place. Otherwise, you're reduced to just asking people, and if it's something like that, they're probably, if they're going to comply in the first place, they were going to, and if they're going to blow you off, they were going to. But you need to be able to catch those people that were going to blow you off. You need to regularly audit your entire network for problems. Because like I said, a lot of times you don't necessarily know that this machine off in the corner was really a critical server. So you need to sweep your whole network. You need to sweep your whole network as often as possible. Okay, several times a week if you can. Now I know that on a large network, somebody just chuckled, and I understand. The problem is that a lot of security auditing tools are very, very slow. But work out what you can. We audit the external networks at Microsoft 3 times a week, and we do the internal network 1 a week. Talking 100,000 machines. It's a lot of hosts. But we've got some very efficient tools, and we feel like it's very, very important to get on problems and correct them quickly. If you just sweep, say, your external network 1 a month, it's no good, because people set up insecure systems every day, and the less the lag time is between when you catch them and when you get it corrected, the smaller the window is for somebody to come in and hack you. Okay, intrusion detection. This is kind of a controversial topic. There's a presentation later on today on this very issue. From looking at his slides, I think he largely agrees with me on this. I think it's an essential component of modern network security, but there are some definite downsides. You need to plan on devoting substantial resources to dealing with detected incidents. We have on the order of 10,000 attacks per hour on our networks. And that's just monitoring certain segments of the network, okay? You know, that's one of the interesting things about being in operational security at Microsoft. You feel like you're walking around with a big target painted on your back, because we really are. We're probably one of the most favorite places for people to hit or try to hit. Even if you can't respond to many incidences, the IDS data can be used as a leverage. You know, you can have an executive walking around saying, well, you know, I'm not sure we should devote a lot of money to this. I'm not convinced it's a big threat. I'm not convinced it's a big problem. You show them some IDS reports that say, well, we're getting hit with 5,000 of these attacks per day and 4,000 of those, and, you know, and those are just the ones that we're catching. They're not all of them. Then all of a sudden, the scope of the problem becomes apparent to them, and you may be able to get more buy-in, more funding, more personnel to be able to handle the problem. Because one of the things that people come to me an awful lot is say, well, you know, I'm really trying to convince my management that this is a real problem and it deserves real resources. How do I do that? IDS logs can help. Okay, one of the, there's really two flavors of intrusion detection. One is obviously host-based. It can identify types of attacks that are not easily recognized by a network-level intrusion detection system. There are certain things that will only log on the host because there's ways of obfuscating attacks to make them very difficult to detect across the wire. Attacks against web servers in particular are kind of interesting that way. It ranges from gathering logs to packet level analysis. There's a number of really interesting tools out there that do this. Downside is that it can be very expensive. Generally the people who make the software are kind of proud of it, and by the time you start multiplying that times the number of machines you need to put it on, you're looking at spending a lot of money. And it consumes resources on the machine. Your admin might very well come to you and say, look, you know, I have a hard time buying enough CPU to handle the load that I'm running in the first place. And no, you're not going to put more software on my machine. Does it eat CPU cycles? Then no, it's not sitting on my box. And sometimes that's a very reasonable response for them to have. Now then there's network-based intrusion detection. It's a lot easier to deploy because I don't have to run around putting it on every machine everywhere. I can put it on a few machines at choke points where I've got a small enough network traffic level to be able to actually get anywhere with it. You have to be careful with it because it does have some pretty strong bounds on the number, the traffic rates that it can analyze. And particularly at Microsoft, we're sitting on a lot of bandwidth, so that's a big problem for us in particular. It makes it very difficult to deploy a network-based IDS in many cases. And it can also be expensive. And they don't catch all the attacks. You've got fragment attack packets that can sometimes slip through depending on how they've put the thing together. If an IDS decode is looking for the presence of a certain string, then an attacker can break the packets into two where the string is split, and that'll slip past a lot of detection systems. Fragmented packets are kind of a difficult situation to begin with. They screw up a lot of different things, so IDS among them. Another is encoded URLs. If, say, it's looking for something.php to look for the PHF attack, and I take that PHF and encode it as, you know, percent whatever, whatever, well, maybe it won't catch that percent whatever, whatever. Or maybe I just take the H and encode it. That might slide past as well. So there's limits to it. There are things that it won't detect. and it obviously can't detect attacks within an encrypted stream. All it sees is an encrypted stream going by, has no idea what's inside the encrypted stream, and it doesn't handle high packet loading well. But despite its faults, would I rather know about some of the attacks that are trying to get me, or would I rather know about none of the attacks that are trying to get me? I'll take some of the attacks, and I'll hope that the IDS vendors will continue to improve their products so that I'm dealing with a better product as I go along. Okay, some of the sources of information need to monitor is your mailing list, your security bulletins, that type of thing. And you need somebody paying attention to that. You need somebody paying attention to that all the time. I got up this morning, I plugged in my laptop, I read BugTrack. I read NT BugTrack. Even though I'm off at a conference, I need to know what's coming down the pike. Did somebody announce something that is a threat to my network security? If that's out there, I need to know it. Need to be prepared to react quickly to events. Attacks often come within hours of an announced issue. You see things coming in very, very, very quickly. Somebody will, I think, irresponsibly post full exploit code to BugTrack or whatever, and immediately you've got hordes of script kiddies coming after you. So if you do not react quickly to these things, if you do not have a capability to, in some cases, roll out critical patches within hours of release, you're going to leave your networks vulnerable. And it's your responsibility to get those patches rolled out. It's your responsibility to understand what these bulletins mean and be able to assess them. Because some of these things, you know, I'm not worried about necessarily. Well, okay, well, somebody can take over my machine locally. All right, that's a problem. Well, somebody can take over my machine from the internet. Somebody can take over my web service from the internet. That's a really big problem, and I get excited about those. Okay, so know what to get excited about and know what not to get excited about. This seems really simple, but a lot of people neglect it. There needs to be somebody at every organization, maybe more than one, whose job it is to spend time every day reviewing these sources of information, because time is critical. Okay. Vendor security bulletins are one of your prime sources of information. We don't put out bulletins for stuff that doesn't matter. If we've gone to the trouble to put out a bulletin, read it, evaluate it, understand it, get a plan for rolling out that patch, particularly if it's something that affects you across the network. Visit our security website. We've got a lot of really good information out there. We've got some checklists. We've got, how do you secure an IIS server anyway? That sort of thing. There's a lot of really good stuff out there. Most other vendors typically have security sites, or they have security bulletins. If you use somebody extensively, subscribe to those. For example, your routers are part of your critical infrastructure. Those are part of your, you know, really critical systems. So you need to pay attention to issues with those. Did Cisco just ship a new firmware for, you know, my router over here? You know, maybe there's a really good reason they shipped that firmware. Let's make sure that we stay up to date there, because routers are a very favorite place for a hacker to go after. If they control your router, they can control a lot of things. Need to stay current on your mailing lists. The ones that I personally find most useful are BugTrack by some of the friends over at Security Focus. It's a little higher geek content than some of the other ones, but it's very useful. It handles a very wide variety of security issues. If you're interested in firewalls and firewalling, the one that I like best is the firewall wizards list run by Marcus Ranum, who did the keynote yesterday. A very good list. It's a moderated list. It's not really very high noise. And you get a lot of insight into some of the technical issues that are going on securing your network. NT Bug Track, run by Russ Cooper, is a lot lower noise. It's a lot lower volume, and it only deals with Windows NT issues. But as such, if you're interested in Windows NT stuff, it's a good single point place to go to get up-to-date and timely information. Lastly, there's a new list that's been set up by my friend Mark Edwards over at Windows 2000 magazine, www.ntsecurity.net. And that also has a lot of good coverage. And he also as well has a how-to list, which I don't think there's too many other ones out there. So there's some lists where people can ask, you know, well, how the heck do I do this? And, you know, pretty basic questions and that type of thing. And occasionally, if I have time, I can be seen answering questions on that list. So that's something else to check out and be aware of. He's got a pretty good security site as well. And I also find it useful to monitor several sites that overlap, because a lot of times you see the same things turn up on all the lists, but sometimes they'll turn up on one list before the other. Sometimes they'll only turn up on one list. So keep pay attention to those and keep track of them. Okay. So you've been hacked. All right, everybody, it happens to everybody eventually. If you don't think you've been hacked, well, look harder at your network. You probably have. So one of the key things in dealing with this is, how do you get the hacker back out of your network? My coworker says it's about like trying to get pee out of a swimming pool. The analogy is very apt. How are you going to get it out? Once they're in there, how do you get them out? Well, basically, you need to drain the pool. Okay? So one of the first things is understanding forensics. What do you do when you're dealing with a box that is been hacked? All right, how do I preserve the evidence? How do I find out the extent of the problem? Did they just come in and deface a web page? Or did they install a rootkit? You've got two different levels of problem. Okay, first of all, biggest thing is put a brand new system in place. Get that one offline. Put something else that's built up from fresh, has all the latest security patches. Throw that one up instead. Take the other one offline, back it up, and then you can start looking at it. Once you have a good solid backup, you also need that good solid backup for possible legal action. If you want to sue the script kiddie that hacked you, or you want to throw the script kiddie who hacked you in jail, you're going to need this for evidence. Not only that, but it's a good thing to have just to you know, just to be able to analyze the situation. Things not to do. Oh, well, go log on to it and check the timestamp on a file. Wrong. Wrong move. As soon as you log on, for one thing, they have the possibility of stealing your credentials. Second thing they can do that's going to happen is you're going to change the timestamp on a few hundred files as soon as you log on. If you use the wrong method to check the other file, you'll change the timestamp on it. You are already muddying your waters. This is really, really important stuff. The smartest thing you can do in most cases, though there are some ins and outs to this, is pull the plug. Pull the network cable and pull the power cable out of the wall. Bring it down. The next time that thing comes up, the hard drive should be attached to a backup system. It should not boot again. Take it off the line. The worst, the stupidest thing that you can ever do is just fix the immediate problem and keep running. Oh, well, it was vulnerable to the RDS exploit. I've applied the patch now, so I'm fine. Wrong answer. The hacker may have come in through the front door, but they've run around, they've unlocked all your windows, and they've dug a tunnel out of your basement. If you may recall, when the New York Times got hacked, the part of the news article said, well, they spent days struggling for control of their systems with the hackers. They'd throw the hackers out, they'd come right back in. The problem was they didn't follow these basics. If they'd taken that machine offline and put up a new one, they wouldn't have been going through that. What they were trying to do was patch the machine while it was running, and the people had already installed umpteen rootkits. And every time they'd find one, they'd throw them out, and then the hackers would just resort to something else that they'd thrown in there, and they'd keep coming back. All right? I don't know how many times I've seen an admin say, well, you know, what? How bad could it possibly be? You know, get creative. It can be real bad. Or another thing not to do, particularly if you suspect that a domain has been compromised at a high level, is change all the passwords. You know, I've seen situations where, you know, you go rip something completely apart, you tell them, say, look, you have to change all the passwords on this entire domain, especially the admin passwords. I come back 6 months later, there's three of them that are still valid. That's no good. That's no good at all. It won't help you get recover from a hack. So that's all part of managing security, is knowing what to do when these types of things happen. Now, it looks like I'm finishing up a good bit early, so I'll be happy to take questions for the duration of the time. And I'm glad to see I'm not going to keep you from lunch. Biggest things to remember is security management has the strongest effect on overall security. You can do everything else right, but if you don't manage your security properly, you're not really going to be getting everything you can out of your operating systems and out of your network. You need to define a security policy, you need to enforce that policy, you need to monitor your intrusion attempts, and you need to be able to react promptly to all of these things. So I'm out of slides, and I'll be happy to go to questions from here. Yes? The question is when you need to change all the passwords, a lot of times it's difficult to change passwords on service accounts because you have a hard time finding all the dependencies. The most important thing is to know where those service accounts exist. You need to understand the scope of the machines that are affected. If your problem is well, I need to change the _foo service account, and you don't know where all the machines are that the _foo service account has been installed on, then you've got a really, really bad problem. If you know where all the machines are, it's certainly annoying, and it's not a trivial problem, obviously, to change all the passwords on a domain, particularly out from under services. You know, I understand that problem completely. Like, for example, if you have to change the password on an SQL server, it could take several minutes for an SQL server to go up and down, and meanwhile you've got some sort of mission-critical application that's not providing services. And so that's a it's a hard problem. And so I'm not going to gloss over it. The biggest thing that you need to do is you need to understand where all those machines are, because the worst thing that can happen is you can say, well, I need to change the underscore foo account, and so far as I know, it's installed on this machine, that machine, the other machine, and you know, I go change that password, I roll that out, and then I bounce the services with the new password, and then I've got 10 other machines I didn't know about that break. Also, SC from the resource kit can be used to reconfigure services from a lot of different angles. It's a very, very handy tool, and so you can script your password changes. Yet another thing, and this is actually very important, is you need to be able to manage service password changes on a regular basis anyway. And so you need to develop a strategy for doing that. So if you've got a strategy in place for changing those passwords on a regular basis, and you know how to do it, you've got the bugs ironed out, you've got your script written, and that type of thing, then if you have a security incident that causes you to change those passwords, what you're doing is you're just doing a routine, regular thing on an unscheduled basis instead of having to really scramble. Yes. What is our password frequency change? I probably should dodge that one. It's every few weeks. We normally rotate all our passwords on every few weeks basis. I'd rather not give out the exact number of days. And we try to make sure that all passwords expire and do get regularly changed. We feel like that's really important. I don't like to see a password where it hasn't been changed in 5 years, that sort of thing, because there's probably 1,000 people that have left the company that know that password, and that's not a situation I like to see. Yes? Yes. The question was, I have custom tools that I use to scan my networks. I have perhaps a unique benefit of having written a really good network security auditing tool at my last job, and I know everything that I didn't do the way I wanted to there. So I've got an awful lot of 20/20 hindsight. So these are tools that I've built myself to suit the needs of our particular network. I don't anticipate that we have a really big interest in getting into the security auditing tool business. There's a lot of people who do that already. Now, one thing I would put forth is that if you have a big enough organization, it's probably a smart thing to be able to develop some capability of your own to be able to write custom tools to check your network, whether it be with Perl scripts or batch files or C code is really the best way to go, I think, C++, whatever. Because a lot of these things come out really very quickly, and your security vendors will normally take weeks to come out with a check to see if a machine is vulnerable. You may be able to put one together on your own more rapidly than that. And, well, okay, it's not perfect. It doesn't feed into my database. It creates some big, horrible text file that I have to grep through, etc. But at least you've got some way of protecting yourself. Also, there are no tools that can scan, that commercial tools that I'm aware of that exist that can scan our internal network as often as I want them scanned, so I wrote one that did. So that's what we do. I also know how much work it is to go from what I've got now to a commercial security auditing tool. And I've done it once, and I don't particularly want to do it again. Yes? Right now, we're using RealSecure on some portions of our network. We are looking at two other IDSs right now and have they're under evaluation. I don't know how we'll eventually roll out all that. There's actually strengths and weaknesses to all of them. They all do some things really right, and some things we'd like to see done better. But that's the primary one we're using right now. Yes, the... Okay, the questions were, how often do we war dial our phone number range, and do we use Secure ID? I would bet we use Secure ID somewhere. It's a big place. I don't know that one. The other question is, how often do we war dial our phones? I know that we do. I don't know how often we do. You find some interesting things war dialing your phone numbers, and that's actually something I probably should have put in the presentation here, because it is an important thing to look at. Let's see. The guy right next to you had a question. The question is how do I document my machines and the services running on them? We have a lot of internally built tools that we use to track changes in our network. For example, we've got a tool that's used to add accounts and add accounts properly so that everything gets done and set correctly. And then we've also got something that comes along and sweeps behind that and looks for any accounts that are added that were not done through the tool. Okay, so we're able to catch all sorts of stuff in that manner. So we've got internal tools that keep track of where people install things. Additionally, I've got databases from my weekly sweeps of the network that, so I'll go out and gather that type of information, and so I can understand that. Yes? How we manage dial-up security? Well, my boss will like that one. He's been a big champion of this one. We nearly continuously sweep our dial-up systems for security problems on a hour-by-hour basis, because they're always popping up and down. It's a difficult problem, and part of your issue is that if somebody can compromise a machine that's, say, you know, dialed in, the next time it connects to CorpNet, it could, you know, actually cause a big problem. So we do two things. We sweep them constantly. There's a small enough area to where they get scanned about once every hour and a half, 2 hours, and it just keeps running. The other thing that we've done and is we've created some internal tools to help people avoid some of the more obvious mistakes. You may be seeing that outside later, I'm not sure. So we're trying to help people internally, and hopefully if it works out really well for ourselves internally, we can spread that to everyone else. So that people can more easily secure their systems, because those dial-up nodes really are something that make me nervous from a security guy standpoint, because essentially they've just become part of your perimeter. And the reality is you're going to have to run your network and allow that unless you've got some kind of very draconian policy. Yes? What's our policy on outbound tunnels? We don't like them. It's hard to stop that kind of thing, and in some cases, depending on how clever they are or what they've put up. That's a difficult problem. Do we have any mechanisms to enforce that? Yes, to some extent. We fairly tightly regulate how you can get out of the internal network, and we log that. And so those logs are available for a period of weeks afterwards, and we do periodically review those logs. So that's how we go after that particular problem. Next question. Yes. How do I distinguish? How do I distinguish a compromised system from a misconfigured system? Typically, it really depends. It completely depends on what's been done to it and how good the hacker is. If something's been invaded by script kiddies, there's usually some very telltale signs. You'll see a lot of times user privileges that are really badly out of whack. You'll see like all the users with stuff like act as part of the operating system privilege, that type of thing. Those are very definite clues that something's been hacked. Sometimes will detect that, well, you know, I've got audit logs from 10 different machines showing that this machine over here is trying to log into them. Gee, why is that? And golly, the owner of that machine's been out of his office all week. I don't think it's him. Maybe we ought to go yank that one. An obvious clue is when you wake up in the morning and find out you're on CNN. Yes? Okay, the question is what's the appropriate level of access to give to end users, particularly on laptops where they need to be able to install software? This is going to be something that's very, very site-specific and depends on what level of software that you want to allow people to install. Some places you really want to clamp down, you don't want to let them install even screensavers. The other is this. The other extreme, of course, is where you're just going to allow them to install anything you like. One of the neatest changes in Windows 2000 in particular is that you can generally get just about everything you need done as a power user on the system. And so you can let your users run as power users, whereas in the past they probably needed to be able to run as administrators to get their jobs done. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a much better solution. They'll stay out of a lot more trouble running as power users, and you'll find that they can get done just about everything they need to get done. Now, in certain circumstances, you're going to run into problems where stuff just simply won't install under anything other than the administrator account. And the approach that I personally like there is to give them a local account that's administrator level, that has no rights on the network, and let them log in as that to get that done. If it's a rare enough situation, it doesn't really impact them. There's also a run as command in Windows 2000 that allows you to run things under a different security context, and so you can often get things installed using that, and that's a big help as well. It's a tricky problem. Yes. To what extent is the dependency chain problem alleviated if I don't have NetBIOS running? Is that the question? It's not particularly. It's not a question of whether I got NetBIOS running or not. It's a problem on all networks. It could be a problem if I was running a cluster of Unix boxes with NIS. It could be a problem if I was running a cluster of Unix boxes without NIS, because people can't remember 500 different passwords, so they're going to tend to use the same password in more than one place. Thus, the dependency chains will still exist. This is a general computer security problem. It really has very little to do with the particular flavor of operating system that you happen to be running on your network. Next question, please. Yes. The question is do we use file system hashes to determine if things have been compromised? On occasion, we do, though, to be honest with you, that's something I would like to see a lot more used a lot more often. I'd also like to see, personally, better tools written for that. Tripwire is a really pretty cool tool, but it's not... As my friend Greg Hoagland will point out, once the operating system's been compromised, you can no longer trust anything that it tells you. Therefore, the only proper way to test such a thing is with the system offline. And so you need to be able to boot it to some sort of alternate system. Because for all I know, if I'm dealing with somebody that's been attacked by somebody of Greg's caliber, then when I go to read the file, it's going to point me at the original file, but when I go to execute it, it's going to point me at something else or something along those lines. So these hashing tools are a great start. Another neat thing that you can do is you can use certificates to sign individual files and individual groups of files and generate signatures from them, and you can use cryptographic signatures to check those as well. And it can be a useful technique, though it's a little bit cumbersome, and I think that's something I'd like to see made a lot easier to use, because it should be used on a more widespread basis. Next. Yes.
Kind of following up on that, though, I think signs of something like MD5 on there, like any signs of Microsoft might be doing that, go off and check if you're saying no.
Well, actually, it's already in the operating system. All the drivers are signed. If you want, you can tell the operating system to check all the drivers for signatures on boot. A lot of that's all already there. Now, I'm not familiar with exactly what they're doing, and so I don't know the details of how they compare with what we're doing. So to give you a really complete answer, I'd have to follow up later. More questions? Jason. Oh, ask that question again from Jason Garms in his session later today. He apparently knows the answer to that, so or you could probably pin him down right after my talk and individually, and he'd probably tell you the answer then too. Any more questions, or is everyone fleeing for lunch?